The Migration Policy Institute hosts a panel discussion on the federal role in immigrant integration, too little, too much, or just right. The panel is moderated by Margie McHugh, co-director of MPI's National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy, which bestowed the 2010 E Pluribus Unum Prizes recognizing exceptional immigrant integration initiatives. The discussion was opened by Suzette Brooks Masters, a program specialist at the J.M. Kaplan Fund, which is providing generous support for the E Pluribus Unum Prizes program. Suzette began with a brief discussion of the Kaplan Fund's work in the field of immigrant integration and offered an overview of each of the 2010 prize winners, as well as the sole honorable mention. Here's Suzette.
I want to welcome you today to the lovely DAR Hall. It's such a fitting place to be having an event like this, given that the Daughters of the American Revolution were clearly some of our earliest immigrants. So I am Suzette Brooks Masters. I direct the immigration grant making at the J.M. Kaplan Fund, which is a private family foundation in New York City whose founder was himself the child of immigrants from Eastern Europe. The J.M. Kaplan Fund started its immigration grant-making program in 2000, and since, I would say, the last 3 years has been really focusing on identifying and highlighting and thinking about exemplary immigrant integration efforts like the ones we're going to be speaking about today. On behalf of the Foundation's board and executive director, some of whom are here today, I'd just like to say how proud we are to sponsor the E Pluribus Unum Awards, today's panel discussion, and tonight's reception, which I hope many or all of you can attend. Too often, the immigration debate is heavy on drama and rhetoric, and unfortunately, pretty short on solutions. And what I'm hoping is that today, the solutions take center stage. Sorry, I wasn't speaking loudly enough. And I can tell you from having read 850 inspiring applications from groups around the country over the last 2 years that there is absolutely no shortage of great work, innovative work, inspiring work that's happening all over the country. And that's what we're going to celebrate today at the panel level and at the awards ceremony tonight. So I have the great privilege now of actually telling you who won the awards, because the panelists will include the awardees. So I get to be the first person to let the cat out of the bag. So I'll be very brief, and you have more information in the booklets on your chair, and you'll learn more, obviously, on the Migration Policy Institute website and at tonight's ceremony. But there were four awardees and one honorable mention that were chosen after a very rigorous process, and I'm going to just tell you a little bit about each one. So as you know, the awardees are each going to receive a prize of $50,000, and I'm just going to run through the four very quickly. So the first is the Illinois New Americans Integration Initiative, and that is a partnership between the Illinois Department of Human Services and the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. It makes immigrant integration a deliberate strategic priority of the state. And as many of you know, the state of Illinois was the first state in the country to adopt an immigrant integration effort by executive order in 2005. And we really all owe a lot to the state of Illinois. The next awardee is the Latino Community Credit Union. And they are a North Carolina-based, member-owned, nonprofit financial institution with 10 branches across North Carolina. They were founded in 2000 to really offer financial services and financial education to the Latino community in North Carolina and to various unbanked populations. They now have 54,000 members. The third is the Tacoma Community House. It was founded a century ago to help Italian immigrants settle in the Puget Sound area in Washington. And today, that traditional settlement house has shown how it has adapted and evolved over the last century to meet the needs of every new wave of immigrants that has made its way to its shores. And today, the Tacoma Community House's executive director is actually playing a leadership role in the state of Washington's efforts to implement its immigrant integration initiative. And the final awardee is Upwardly Global, affectionately known as UPGLO, which was founded in 2001. It's a San Francisco-based organization which also has offices in New York and Chicago. They provide job readiness training, career counseling and placement, and mentoring to skilled immigrants and refugees. And they focus particularly on the niche of immigrants who are unemployed or underemployed because they've had a hard time using their foreign credentials, academic and other forms of professional credentials, to full advantage in the U.S. workplace. Then, I'd also like to mention the one honorable mention that we have this year, which is the McDonald's Corporation, for their program called English Under the Arches. It's a three-year-old, very innovative workplace English instruction program that provides shift managers with the language skills they need to manage restaurant operations and staff and move up the job ladder. So if you would join me in giving a hearty round of applause to this year's winners. And now I'll just turn the podium over to Margie McHugh from the Migration Policy Institute. Thank you.
Thank you, Suzette. Well, I'm Margie McHugh. I'm the co-director of MPI's National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy. I have the pleasure of introducing you to the awardees that are up here and having a conversation with them about the work that they're doing. And then Michael Fix, who co-directs the center with me, will be running the second panel. Is there something funny happening with my mic? No? It's okay. Thank you all for taking the time to be here. We're delighted to see you all. And, of course, we're delighted to have arrived at this moment with our second group of awardees. This is our second year of the program, and we're just so grateful to the J.M. Kaplan Fund for helping us to raise up not just the wonderful work that's happening at the local level with so many organizations that have been doing, as you just heard, in some cases, terrific work for over 100 years on these issues, but also to give them their moment in the sun or sort of raise up the policy, the programs and practices that they're using, but also to try and insert these more directly into the immigration debate. Thinking that the debate really needs to be more balanced and be looking at some of these issues related to immigrant integration, and that, in fact, part of untying some of the knots that we're in terms of immigration policy might very well have to do with paying more attention to these immigrant integration issues and showing what it takes to be successful with them at the local level. So let me start by telling you who's who up here on the panel. To my immediate left is Betsy McKay from McDonald's English Under the Arches program, Nikki Cicerani from Upwardly Global, Luis Pastor from the Latino Community Credit Union, and Liz Dunbar from the Tacoma Community House in Tacoma, Washington. Unfortunately, Johan Uven from the U.S. Department of Education had a family emergency, so he's on a transatlantic flight right now, hopefully making his way around the ash cloud and getting home to deal with that. So this panel, we intend to talk about the cluster of issues that have to do with immigrants' ability to enter into the workforce, move up in it, get the English skills that they need, and also build the financial solvency and skills and wealth in order to succeed in the country. And we intend to leave plenty of time for questions at the end. We've left small index cards, I believe, in your programs that if you think of questions and just want to get them up to us quickly, you can just write them up and we'll pass up and down the aisles occasionally to collect them. But we'll also have the chance for you to just ask questions from the floor after we get a few of the issues on the table. So, Liz, I thought I would start with you since there is a cluster of these adult education issues among the awardees this year. And since you have a multi-service approach and since you've been involved in refugee resettlement issues for many years and have had a chance to view these issues from a number of different vantage points, immigrants come in with very different levels of education and also English language skill. So it is a bit of a matrix, I guess, that policymakers and program directors need to think about in terms of just planning where they're going to fit into that sort of hierarchy of the different types of services and how to get them funded and the like. So could you just talk a little bit about what it's like to try and do that from the ground up, given the varying funding streams and the different needs that the immigrants that you see have?
Well, it's no surprise to say that it's a challenge. Let's see if I can move this so you can hear me. Does that work better?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'll try to speak up. It certainly is a challenge. I think the funding sources do tend to focus pretty exclusively on work and work-related English, and people come to us for lots of different reasons, and so we really try to develop an approach that recognizes the breadth of needs that individuals and families have for the use of English, basic survival English, and being able to learn about the society and the culture that they're entering, as well as actually learning the vocabulary and things that they need for work. So we try to really make that broad. We also, fortunately, we're at the scale where we can provide classes that are fairly distinct. So we don't put students at all different levels together. We are able to we have to test all of our students at the beginning, and then we put them in classes at levels that meet their needs. If they're very low-level students, we often start them with volunteer tutors. And so we have a variety of strategies to help make sure that what we're doing makes sense for them and for the other students in the classes. We also are very fortunate to have very experienced teachers with good credentials who have done this work for a number of years, many of whom have taught overseas, and so they are able to work effectively with very diverse classes and help make all that work. So it certainly is a challenge, and a challenge as the funding streams have gotten narrower and narrower and more and more limited to try to provide the kind of quality, robust program that we think people really need and deserve.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Terrific. 10 other follow-ups we could ask you, but I'll just ask Nikki to jump in here, though, for a minute and maybe talk a little bit about the particular needs that immigrants who come to the country with college degrees or work experience from other countries, their issues with trying to translate those into the U.S. job market.
Right. The major barriers that they face, they're before that I would name, that I think come up primarily after the English is taken care of. So assuming English is sufficient to job search, for those who have significant education and are trying to rebuild their careers, the main barriers they face are lack of knowledge of the U.S. job search norms. Everything from the resume onto what would be required in marketing oneself or interviewing in the U.S., as you can well imagine, it becomes a very nuanced process in terms of how much command you have over the English language when somebody asks you, tell me about a time you made a mistake and what you learned from it, or tell me about your greatest weakness can also be one of those cultural questions where it would be bizarre, or even more bizarre in many cases for those coming from other countries is, what's your greatest accomplishment? And to have to speak in a self-promotional way. So in part, it's just the expectation of the U.S. employer community about how one presents oneself and their accomplishments in order to secure a job. Beyond that, it would be lack of a network. Many of our immigrants come because they have, they're here as asylees or refugees. About a third of those that we work with came to the United States as an asylee or a refugee. Many came through the diversity lottery and then obviously through family reunification. But when they get here, usually their networks are not their former colleagues from their home country, those that can speak to their skills or experience or open those critical doors for them. I often note in my own experience, having grown up in a very blue-collar family and then going to Cornell and being the only person in my family about what do you do with sort of this degree type thing and who's going to even make an introduction like that for me, and was very fortunate to have a professor from my university who said, there's this company called Ernst & Young. And because he gave me a warm introduction when I actually spelled it as Ernest and Young and sent my resume in, they still managed to interview me. Surprise! And I worked there for 4.5 years, so all turned out well. But the point is that they come without those kinds of connections. And additionally, the employers don't always know how to evaluate that foreign credential or how to evaluate foreign experience against other candidates who may be applying with more recognizable degrees, who may have work experience at the names of companies, simply they feel more comfortable with. And so the education on the employer side is lacking, and then there's simply the credentialization issue. So the non-transferability of an engineer, a civil engineer in their home country, the amount of time and the barriers that one needs to be able to address in order to rebuild their careers in the United States can be a significant barrier to having a professional career. And so many wind up either in unskilled jobs or significantly underemployed for long, long periods of time if they ever do regain, let's say, the level of skill in their occupation that they had in their home country.
Mm-hmm. So just to stay on the adult ESL's system and provision issues for a minute, I'm thinking, Liz, about the effort that you were a part of in Washington State with their executive order on immigrant integration, and that this issue of how to even have the state begin to think about, never mind embrace, how different the issues were depending on the immigrant group they were talking about in the state, that some people were starting with basically no native language literacy. Others are some of the people that Nikki is talking about, who maybe have very high degrees of native language literacy, even advanced degrees, but there's not really the English, those sorts of classes for them to move into occupations. My understanding is that there's the hope that Washington State might look at that as part of their executive order and try to think about how to meet the need. Is that something that is still going forward, or maybe kind of doesn't have as much energy because of the budget issues in the state?
Well, certainly the budget has been a barrier and a challenge to moving forward. The council did make a number of recommendations, and we benefited from the experience of some of these other award winners. Illinois, of course, has blazed the trail in the work that they did, and we followed their path a lot, and we talked to people from Overly Global and got your ideas and incorporated those in our recommendations. And there, we tried to be very creative about ways that you could do some of these things without necessarily new money, but really trying to bring government resources to bear on these things as they look at how they do business now. When we talked to the governor about the issues of professional people and becoming recertified, that was something that she actually put in the executive order as a personal interest of hers, and said that, you know, there are veterans who are coming back from military service who face the same issues, that their training isn't necessarily recognized, and maybe we can join forces and work on both of those populations together. So there are those potentials for looking at things a little bit differently. Also, because we had someone from the Gates Foundation on the council who was willing to take a look at public-private partnerships around English language learning, we're pursuing those ideas and possibly some pilot projects that initially would be funded with foundation money, but if those prove to be successful, then they may become models that could be incorporated into the government-funded program. So we're trying to be creative about how we approach these things so that people can't say that it's a bad budget time, we can't do anything. Let's find ways to keep moving and make some progress, and then keep these issues on the radar, so as the economy improves and we're able to invest more, that we have some very specific things we can do.
Makes a lot of sense. I think there's also hope that that more states will start to think of planning in that way, particularly if there's going to be a legalization program at some point in the near future, because then that would, well, we can talk about that a little bit later, but, you know, trigger more need. So, Betsy, one of the, I know that one of the things that Washington State had their eye on in terms of trying to think about capacity and who might meet the needs of people depending on either where they were at in the labor force or in their process of learning English, was what might the role of employers be in that? And so I think your phone's going to be ringing a lot because there's been a great deal of interest in really what might employers do, especially since the most precious resource that adults have is their time, And the model that that McDonald's has come up with is one that is helping people to right from their place of work be able to it's not really phone in, it's a form of web conferencing, right. So do you want to talk a little bit about what you think the promise of that sort of technology is, and you know, also as someone from the business world, what do you think is the promise of those sort of actions on the part of corporations that, you know, might look at this issue and want to step in a little more?
Well, there are a couple different aspects to that. As we were designing the program for our shift managers, we knew several things. One, we wanted to keep the relationship that students can form with an instructor. That kind of bond is critical, especially in terms of learning a language. The trust that's established within a class and the teacher is vitally important. At the same time, we knew that our folks often had two full-time jobs and had family responsibilities, and it just wasn't likely that they would be able to take advantage of some of the community programs, either in the evening or on their days off. So we tried to figure out a way to bring those instructors to them. And so we developed a hybrid, a blended model, which incorporates some face-to-face, but also adds a substantial part of the course in what we call virtual classes. And so in a virtual class, if you picture 6 or 7 or 8 restaurants in a given geographic area and 1 or 2 students in each one, and at 3 o'clock on Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday, they go back to the crew room and log in and get on the phone, and their class of maybe 15 students and the teacher are all on together. And so the teacher does have slides that she's showing through the, or he's showing through the computer. But essentially, they get all of the same kinds of activities, exercises, that they would get in a face-to-face class. And we tried it. We thought, well, it would be a way of eliminating some of the travel and the face-to-face classes. What we didn't count on was that it actually was very helpful to do it that way, because, you know, when you're learning a language, speaking on the telephone is just the hardest thing to do. Well, after these students had spent 48 hours literally on the telephone, they lost that fear. So it had a side benefit. We also supplement that with e-learning, which is specifically designed to amplify that particular week's lesson, and on-the-job practice. So they can practice in a safe environment in the class, but then they need to apply those, whatever they're learning that particular week, with their colleagues, with their managers, with the customers, etc. And so we wrap all of the grammar and the vocabulary, et cetera, all around a contextualized curriculum, which is the language they need and hear every day to manage a shift at McDonald's.
I think one of the very exciting things about what you've done for those employers who are afraid to wade into these issues because they think, oh, no, I'm not an English language instruction expert, and, you know, how do I don't want to get involved in having to figure out who's an appropriate instructor, what the right. You know, what the curriculum should be, and the like. That you have figured out a way to partner with those who have that expertise.
Yes, we knew right from the beginning that we wanted to leverage the expertise, and for the most part, that's in local community colleges. So as we venture into a particular geographic area, we will talk with a community college to recommend instructors, their very best experienced instructors who are willing to learn a new way of teaching as well, because they need to learn how to teach with this virtual approach. And so far we've met with really, really encouraging results, because community colleges want to expand their own capacity and approaches that they could use in other classes. Mm-hmm. So we've been very, very fortunate in getting outstanding instructors. There's a line. We don't ask them to help the students back in the restaurant with their managers, et cetera. They clearly are there to provide ESL instruction. And then we have some of our own McDonald's folks that act as a liaison between the instructors and the restaurants for any kind of administrative activities.
Makes sense. So, Luis, among the many extraordinary things your organization manages to do, one of them is your curriculum on financial literacy that you've had, that is, as I understand it, has been picked up and awarded and modeled by many other organizations. One of the in the adult education field, of course, part of the conversation is that how you help people do better is by giving them curriculum that is about things that really matter to them. And obviously, you all have hit on a set of issues that really matters to immigrants: how to build wealth and how to protect themselves when they're out there trying to figure out how to make sense of banking and financial services in the U.S. Do you want to talk a little bit about the issues with acquiring English in that context, or do you feel that there are many programs that folks have access to, or just generally, would you like to talk about the need for those sorts of financial literacy services?
Well, probably something that I'm going to be in a different scenario than my the people that are receiving the award with me, is that to receive services in our institution, you don't need to speak English. Mm-hmm. Basically, we have created an institution that welcomes immigrants because it doesn't matter how fluent you are in your English, you prefer to do business in your first language. That doesn't mean that you don't need to learn English. But the profile of our members is very different than the one that you are dealing with. This is low-income, new Americans, just arrived here, third or fourth grade of education. It's people that, but their dreams are the same. I mean, we come here to provide a better future for families. It's impossible to provide a better future if you don't have an institution that helps you with your finance, that lend you money when you need to invest in your future. Call it education, call it house, call it car, or a place that helps you to save money for the future. So we create, the community create the organization, and at the same time we identify that without the right knowledge of how to use these products, the institution is not going to perform as we wanted. I mean, somebody can give you a car for free, but if nobody teaches you how to drive, the most likely thing is that you're going to crash the car. Mm. On the other hand, if somebody gives you a lot of lessons on how to drive a car but never give you the opportunity to buy one, what is the motivation to go there? So merging both things, the financial education and financial products, is the best combination to for people to get to be engaged on the situation. So in 2000, we started looking for a curriculum that fit this need. The new immigrants, mainly from Mexico, third or fourth grade of education, we were unable to find anything. So we decided to write our own curriculum based on our experience with our community, based on our experience as immigrants. All of us in the staff were immigrants. Even our six gringos, they have been immigrants at some point of their life. They have lived outside the United States. It's something that I ask for all the employees. I want you to know what it's been an immigrant. If not, it's very easy to fall in the paternalistic approach that I, the guy that know how the system works, I'm going to teach you. And this is just a community teaching to each other. And that's what the approach that we took for our financial education as well. It's a peer-to-peer education. It's a adult group education. It's not a teacher explaining. It's the group, the between 8 to 10 people talking together how to deal with your finance. Mm-hmm. And this approach is working for us. I mean, it's working for our community. Immigrants who are very young, the average age of our community, of our credit union, is around 26, 27 years old. The average age of members of credit unions in the United States is 47 years old. So we are the future. I mean, we, as a community, but as a credit union as well, we can bring the new generation of people that are interested in managing their lives. And that's performing great.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, so we wanted to take the first part of this this session to give you a sense of the work that the four of these terrific organizations do. And then, of course, the big question is, how do we scale up the things that, you know, in the areas that we know that there isn't sufficient quality, accessibility, just sheer quantity of services. And then we figured we would open up the floor to your questions. So Nikki, just to get us into that a little bit, there is soon going to be an effort out with the Department of Ed here in D.C. to try and get a bit more of a handle on some of the credential recognition issues, looking across federal agencies and trying to figure out what might be able to happen at the federal level to help with that, and then see how that might trickle down to the state level. So you all have done a really amazing program in Chicago trying to, Illinois, I guess, overall, trying to look at mapping a whole bunch of professions and trying to make all that information more transparent to immigrants in terms of what it takes to have their credentials transfer into those. Do you have any insights you want to put out there now, or sort of key policy things that you think are important for folks to have their eye on at the state and federal level to try and remove some of the barriers on these issues? It's just so complicated with how different the rules are state by state.
Absolutely. Probably the greatest finding from our pilot in that area was that when we surveyed the group, both those that we serve as well as immigrant professionals who've been in the country for a long time and have rebuilt, a significant portion actually indicated that they would move to another state that they felt had easier regulations or more support for their ability to rebuild in their regulated field. And that a certain percent, I think it was about 30% actually, that they would start to consider a different country if they in fact felt like there were better opportunities for them to re-enter their career field. So the biggest takeaway that I would communicate is that people are indicating it is influencing where they will take their skills. And then after that, it seems like a couple of things were some of the major takeaways. Initial findings really showed that the opportunity to be an apprentice or an intern in some fields is absolutely required, but the number of opportunities that are out there are so limited. And then in addition to that, even once you sort of muddle through the number of regulations that tests you might have to take or pass, that the financial barrier can be significant for immigrants who come without the financial resources to make that kind of investment in time and additionally. So the result of that work is actually that we're copying our neighbor to the north in some of their best practices. Canada, that has a policy of high-skilled immigration, faces a lot of the same barriers that we address at Upwardly Global with the high-skilled immigrants who are underemployed in the U.S., and this, out of their best practices, we're multi-stakeholder groups. It's bringing together community service organizations, employers, and the government agencies to collaborate about what are the barriers, and having obviously the immigrant professionals indicate what are the major barriers, how are we viewing them, where are they being a hindrance to us actually tapping into this talent pool in order to fill our workforce needs or optimize the talent that's latent today within the skilled immigrant community. And so we are starting now with these multi-stakeholder groups in the fields of engineering and hoping to branch out into healthcare and others as we sort of create our own best practices, starting in what we call our Illinois lab, whereas we've already had collaboration with the state there. And I think really beyond that, looking across from both a federal and a state level, some of the things that we've learned internationally that I would say are probably at a minimum interesting, if not becoming best practices, are a fairness commission to evaluate whether or not at each state level there is, and again, I would have to say, you know, an arm's length standard of fairness with how the regulating bodies are setting the requirements to reenter. And that the federal government in other countries are incenting states. They're providing incentives for states to get this figured out. So they don't want to be as hands-on, but they want to provide incentives for how many immigrants are they getting to pass a certain level of English, and then beyond that back into certain career fields, so mm-hmm. that they're incentivizing the states to find their own solutions.
Mm-hmm. Great. Great. So, Liz, I'm thinking about our conversation this morning. We were lucky enough to have a breakfast this morning that Roberto Rodriguez, who is the White House advisor on education, joined us for, and we had a little bit of time to talk to him about the issues with scaling up the system for adult English language provision. And you started off by saying what a difficult context we're in, because a lot of the trend in these systems is to focus much more on workforce outcomes. And while there is money, particularly in the Workforce Investment Act under Title II, for services that are more general for adult education, a lot of the state matches for that money are kind of disappearing or really under tremendous pressure because of state budget shortfalls and the like. One of the big questions there is, what about the use of volunteers? Are there ways that we might be able to get a little more mileage out of the dollar using volunteers? But of course, there's a lot of folks in the field are very worried about that, saying that there's so many quality issues with that. It looks like in your state that you all have played a pretty big role in testing the limits of that. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I think there is a really important role for volunteers to play in the system, but I think it's dangerous to think about anything in this area as an all-or-nothing or one-solution approach. So for us, volunteers are an important part of the mix, and we did and we still do provide training statewide for literacy volunteers, both on the ESL side and the adult basic education side. And those volunteers are then connected to other programs so that they're not working in isolation. They receive a standardized training that gives them a really solid foundation. But they are also attached to a program that's working with students as well. So I think it's difficult to see a role or a scenario in which you could rely only on volunteers. And even if you do, you still need volunteer management and training and coordination and support. So it's I don't want people to think that that's a free solution. There's still money involved. And I think all of us want to see quality programs and that immigrants get access to programs that will provide them with a high-quality program where they can make gains and make them relatively quickly because they're getting the level of intensity or the level of expertise that's needed to really make that make those gains in their learning. But I think a combination of approaches. I'm really intrigued with the web conferencing idea at McDonald's, and I mentioned earlier that we're in discussions with the Gates Foundation around doing a combination of classroom and having people practice and study on their telephones, on cell phones. Mm-hmm. As the cell phones get more and more capacity to do things, we're exploring whether that's a tool. So I think there's lots of resources, lots of ways you can go, but I don't think there's any one silver bullet here. It will require a combination of strategies to be effective. I think the other point I wanted to make was the challenge going forward for nonprofit organizations. I think we tend to get overlooked a lot in the broader policy discussions around education for adults. They tend to think of this as a higher education, or particularly a community college approach, and community colleges are very important, and we partner with them all the time, but there are nonprofit organizations like ours who can be an important part of the system, and they should be, and they should be recognized as such. We want to be held to the same standards as everyone else, but there are benefits that we can offer and capacity that we can provide that go beyond what the community college system can offer. So we just want to get that out there and get that message across as people look at scaling up programs and at funding, that remember that these funds shouldn't be targeted only to higher ed institutions, but also to others who can meet the same standards and provide the same services.
Right. I think it'll be interesting to see how things play out in California now, where their adult schools have lost a tremendous amount of money over the last year or two, and they were providing almost 75% of the adult DSL instruction in that state. And without, you really don't have a tradition of community-based organizations providing adult English instruction there because the adult school system had been so robust. So I think especially if we start to talk in terms of a legalization program and the needs that that would trigger, or even DREAM Act passing, that the taking a much clearer, harder look at exactly what the need is, exactly who the providers are, you know, and where people need to move to, I think is really a challenge that's facing all of us, you know, as we look forward. I was thinking along those lines, Betsy, that since there is a lot of hope that that business might step in a little more on these issues, do you want to just is there anything that comes to mind in terms of thinking about what business? I know you can't speak for all businesses, but you know what business might need in order to step in more in this area.
Yeah, at this point, I'd say that the lack of any formal structures that would help in the formation of these public-private sector ventures is really a barrier. McDonald's happens to be large enough, even though I say that, but 85% of our restaurants in the U.S. are actually owned by individual franchisees. They're small business owners. At the same time, the name McDonald's obviously has recognition, and so we were able to forge these partnerships or these relationships with interested parties to see, well, what can we cook up? But that was in the absence of essentially knowing how to do it or having a path that was already blazed that we could follow. So we learned a lot in that process and would certainly share that. But if there were some pathways that were more evident, I know there are employers out there saying, gosh, we have the need, but I don't know who to call at a community college. And we have community colleges who say, we want to partner with business. But what do they do? Open the yellow pages? So trying to streamline those connections, I think, would be beneficial to all.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Luis, before I open the floor for questions, you are working in an area that is that's fascinating but unfamiliar to lots of us who have been in the immigrant integration field for a while. The next panel is going to be dealing more with federal versus state policymaking and some of the issues around coordination more broadly, I guess, in terms of you know the issues of integration that cut across a lot of areas. Do you want to put any issues on the table for all of us or for them to think about just from your area of work before we get into the Q&A?
Well,
I'm sorry, I didn't say this to you beforehand, but I thought we had such an interesting conversation last night about, for example, if we have a legalization program with really, really big fines, how will people pay for it? Because there just aren't many of, you know, your kind of organization doesn't exist in many other places. So, you know, maybe that's another thing you want to say something about just so that people have it in their minds going forward from today.
I thought that my family was very peculiar because we never talk about money in my family. We never asked my father how much money he did, or it was a forbidden. But now it looks that in the immigrant community, we don't talk about money neither. That is something that brings us here, all of us. At the end of the day, we come here and we need to deal with money. And we don't know how to deal with money because this system is different. For some countries, it's better. For other countries, it's worse. I mean, this United States doesn't have the most advanced retail banking system in the world. But we need to talk about that. This is something that is really important. It affects our lives every day. There is a few programs. I think our state is a great example or great exception in providing money from the state budget for economic development in minority communities. The U.S. Treasury has the CD5 fund, the Community Development Financial Institution Fund, that gives money for the same reason. You need to be certified. And in this economy, we see that these institutions, we are performing much better than the other communities, the other institutions. So there is a good reason to invest in institutions that are owned and managed by the same people that receive the services. And credit unions are one of them. When we talk about money, there is always issues with money. There is never enough money. But if the same community put the money together in one box, and you put all your resources, and now you need the money is there because the whole community owns the institution. That's going to happen with us. If there is a legalization process in the United States, I was saying yesterday at the dinner that there is not going to be an issue in North Carolina. Nobody's going to be, no immigrant is going to be out of the legalization process because of lack of money, because we own our own financial institution. So we're going to be able to lend money to each other. But that's the beauty of this type of movement. That's the beauty of pulling resources together. That's the beauty of understanding our needs. And again, nobody needs to explain us how an immigrant feels. We know that. Mm-hmm. So there is not going to be... Can this model be replicated? There has been a lot of interesting models following our credit union around the state. In Washington State, they started one in 2001. In 2002, disappeared. There was one here in Washington, D.C. that started in 2005. It never really exploded. I don't think this is lack of number of immigrants in this city what doesn't avoid that. I mean, there is something more. I mean, this is not just a business. This is a business with a social mission and need to be run with this understanding. And if you move to one place or to the other, you lost your goal.
Okay, very helpful. All right, so I think we didn't figure out how to collect cards from you all, or maybe I should have been pushing you on it. So why don't we just take questions from the floor, if any of you would like to comments or questions. And I think we'll take a few just so that that the panel can respond depending on the breadth of things people might ask.
Hi, I'm Joe Montano from the Governor's Virginia Asian Advisory Board, and I've enjoyed listening to everything. I see a lot of conferences and fora out there that really focus on the policy and its, you know, is it enforcement, is it services towards the immigrant population. What I want to know is folks in your shoes, in other direct service agencies and nonprofit organizations, where do you connect? Is there, a group, a network that folks can share ideas, network, share best practices?
Well, you need to hand the microphone to her first because we just created that network because of that need. But I'm sure all of you have ways of connecting within your field, probably, right? But not across. Not for the people who are looking for this specifically, maybe for the immigrant piece of it. I wonder.
Yeah, I think it is a challenge. I think we had we do have some professional networks. Certainly, in the whole ESL field, there are networks, and again, that tends to be dominated by the community colleges, and we have to kind of keep pushing ourselves into that circle to be heard. But as far as nonprofit groups, again, it kind of depends on the topic. So when it comes to refugee resettlement issues, there are networks, and we tend to link up with other groups and collaborate and share information. But there's a lot more that can be done, and I'm really grateful to MPI. I think we're starting to learn a lot more because of this connection and through your immigrant integration virtual center on your website. Hopefully there'll be other things like this where we can find out more about what other organizations do and reach out and make those connections, because it can be very challenging to try to do this work and not have that kind of support system. Yeah.
Anybody else? Nobody really does what you do, right?
In the U.S., nobody focuses, I guess, exclusively on it. So the Welcoming Center for New Pennsylvanians, probably, you know, across Welcome Back Center, exactly. They will serve the breadth from low skill on through to highly skilled. And just because of the proportion, they spend majority of their time and services, obviously, on the low skilled.
Mm-hmm.
But we had the benefit also, J.M. Kaplan funded a, you know, roundtable between practitioners who touched the licensing issue. So we had an opportunity to get together with World Education Services, ourselves, welcome back, yourselves, to talk about, you know, what is the collective approach to this, since it is such a burgeoning field of interest, both at a government level as well as through not-for-profits like ourselves.
And so the reason I was pointing to Monica, who's our program coordinator for the prizes program, is that precisely because we had the sense that people in their issue silos could find out a little, you know, if you were part of those professional networks, but that there really wasn't anything that cut across a lot of the fields. So we just started a NING community about a year ago on our website that has about 1,000 different program practitioners signed up and in various subgroups within it. But you just need to be invited to get into it. It's not a site that you would find publicly. So Monica right here, or just email any of us at MPI, and if you'd like to become a member of that, we'd be happy to let you into it. Any other questions? There in the back.
Congratulations to all of you folks. I have a sort of a related question. In addition to speaking amongst yourselves, Can you talk a little bit about how do you connect with the community that you're serving? How do you do some effective ways of reaching out to your community base? Let them know about these services. How do you, what's some of the effective ways that you folks have found to do that?
Well, in our case, we've been named the fastest growing credit union in the history of this country. And we have never paid a single advertisement. I think advertisement is the price that you pay when you are boring. So you are really have passion for something, you're not going to have any problem going outside and start talking about your program. Our members became ambassadors of our credit union. Our outreach campaigns, they are, we make a partnership with the Mexican consulate, and when they go to do matriculas, we go there and explain. We go to the churches. I mean, you feel this passion, you know it, and you know that you are the most interesting in our field of interest, the most interesting project. I mean, this is the type of motivation they expect from our employees, and it's working. The thing is that the reality is that works. If you have something good to offer, people are going to recognize it, but you need to have something good to offer.
Had to establish programs in three different cities. Do you want to take a whack at that?
Sure. Yeah. What's probably most interesting is our program in Illinois, where because there's been a lot of refugees resettled recently in the Illinois area, specifically a lot of Iraqis who tend to be highly skilled. Our collaboration with the refugee resettlement agencies and them seeing us as a real partner for them to handle this incoming flux, for which their sort of traditional services are not geared towards serving. So we get more than half of our referrals, great majority, and we've been there for a year. What's incredible is that out of every two referrals, I think we accept one of them into our program. So they know exactly who we're looking for. They know exactly who can benefit from the program. Those job seekers come prepared to really take advantage of what we're offering, and it has been a wonderful partnership in Illinois. In San Francisco, where we were founded, we are largely word of mouth at this point, and other community referral agencies. And in New York, which was the second established city, it's sort of split half between. About 50% of our referrals are word of mouth, and about 30 come through other community organizations, Workforce One centers and One Stops. And then people Google us.
Terrific. Yeah. Did you want to add?
Well, we have a slightly different challenge. Obviously, since we're not serving the community in the same way. But even within McDonald's, English Under the Arches is a program that that offers three different course levels. But it really has to be pulled by the individual owner-operators in a community. So they need to see the value of it in order to bring it to their community. And, you know, we decided right in the beginning to measure the heck out of it, so that we would be able to provide some statistics on the students that had participated in the program. And those statistics are quite meaningful. Not so much the proficiency gains on the national assessments, because that doesn't resonate with our owner-operators so much. Certainly the retention rates, so that a year or 2 years after someone has taken the class, there's over a 90% chance they're still going to be in that restaurant moving up through the ranks. That's huge. Also, we rely on the operators to talk to each other. And once they've experienced, once they've seen the changes in their own folks, so if they see Edna, who at this point can't speak English with or very well, at least with a customer, or is afraid to approach a customer, and then in 22 weeks sees someone goes in to say, "I can solve the problems." You know, that's a huge, huge change in an individual, and clearly their investment has paid off since they're paying the instructors and the time for the class.
So being close to the people who need and want what it is, and a lot of good word of mouth very often, and examples. Before we take the next question, does anybody... right there. Let me just say that I was thinking in terms of the last question about how do people find resources, that I wanted to make sure, since we're talking a lot about adult English language instruction, we haven't focused a lot around citizenship, because I think for many of us in the field, we're thinking pretty broadly, and then worried a bit about how to meet the need under legalization or DREAM Act. But I want to recognize the terrific work that the Office of Citizenship is doing, and Rebecca Carson, who's the head of that, is right here with some of her team, and their website is really fantastic, with having a whole lot of different resources on there for people who are teaching English in the context of citizenship, and particularly resources for building the skills of teachers, right? So I think that's another terrific resource for people who are interested in finding out what's happening and related to some of these fields. So I think we can take one more question.
Thank you. Hi, Margie.
Hi, Jim.
I'm Jim Parker, formerly with the U.S. Department of Education, now retired and doing consultant work. In the early part of the 1990s, there was a national workplace education program. It was partnership with local adult ed providers, community colleges, and a whole lot of businesses. In the last funding cycle of that program, which was 1996-97, the majority of the services provided were ESL, in partnering with employers. So, Betsy, you said there was no structure, and you're right, and that's a great observation, certainly no national structure. But there actually was some on a demonstration basis. New Congress in 1994 essentially shut down that program in 96, and so there hasn't been one since like that. However, I'd like you all to pay attention to the Adult Education and Economic Development Act, sponsored by Congressman Hinojosa, and on the Senate side, Brown and Senator Webb. It would take us, I think, a next step. It wouldn't establish a national program for ESL in workplace as such, but it very much supports workplace education. So I think that that's a place we could look, and you might ask that to the next panel also.
Great. Great note to end on, Jim, because we need to move into the next panel, and of course we are very, very interested in figuring out how to think about meeting the need that's out there, and despite the best efforts and some really smart thinking and really aggressive programming and innovation, we know that we're really really long way off from meeting the need that we see out there. And that this isn't an easy time to be trying to figure out how to expand programs. So I'm just so happy that we get to kick that to the next panel. Please join me in congratulating and thanking these awardees for their remarks.
For more information about MPI's work on immigrant integration and the 2010 E Pluribus Unum Prize award winners, please visit www.integrationawards.org.